v. Mitsubishi Motor, 061397. Mr. Crooks.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. This Title VII retaliation case presents a very clear question. It presents an issue regarding when the discriminatory animus of a supervisor can be imputed to a different supervisor that makes a decision to terminate the plaintiff. Now, as we all agree, plaintiff had to make a showing of a causal connection between his protected conduct and the adverse action taken. In this case, he was terminated. The plaintiff did so in the district court during the summary judgment briefing, first of all by timing, and it was very unique timing evidence here because in this case there was a series of protected conduct acts and a series of retaliatory acts, one following the other. In fact, I think very persuasively, on two occasions, there was protected conduct which was followed by retaliatory disciplinary write-ups which related to events that occurred before the protected conduct. I think that's persuasive. But the plaintiff did not depend on timing alone, though I think timing might have been enough in this case. There was also evidence of deception by the supervisor that had discriminatory animus. There were also statements that indicated he was acting in a retaliatory way. Now, the district court did not reject plaintiff's evidence of causal connection. Rather, what the district court did on summary judgment is take the position that plaintiff had shown discriminatory animus by his direct supervisor, Mr. Scott, but the decision was made by someone else. And that someone else, the district court reasoned, had acted in good faith, conducted an investigation, and decided that, in fact, the plaintiff had committed the act which led to his termination. It's our position that this case presents the perfect set of facts that fit within prior decisions of this court that state that the discriminatory animus of the direct supervisor must be imputed to the decision maker. And here's why. What the cases say, and they all say it slightly differently, but it has the same meaning. Day versus Colt says, summary judgment is generally improper where the plaintiff can show that an employee with discriminatory animus, in this case Mr. Scott, provided factual information or other input that may have affected the adverse employment action. In this case, we know it affected it because Mr. Scott accused the plaintiff of striking him, said he punched him. An act for which anyone would automatically be terminated. There was very slim corroborating evidence. If you take out the evidence, the information, the allegations made by Mr. Scott, there's not enough evidence remaining to even conclude that anyone committed a rule violation, much less that the plaintiff had committed a rule violation. Now, the line of cases that are relied on by the defense and were cited by the district court all have a different fact pattern.
What happened to his case before the EEOC and the Illinois Department of Human Rights?
The EEOC charge in this case, my recollection, there never was a decision. I know they granted a right to sue letter and we filed our lawsuit.
How about the Illinois Department of Human Rights?
Again, as to one of the charges that the plaintiff filed, there was a fact-finding conference at which a statement arose that we have cited in this case, but there was never a hearing before the commission in that case. And I'd also indicate that whatever findings
denied.
Or... I'm sorry?
Was the hearing denied, or why wasn't it?
The fact-finding conference was a mixture of fact-finding and settlement conference. There was no decision made at that case.
Well, was it settled?
No, it was not. No, it was not. That's why I lost.
There was no decision by the Illinois Department of Human Rights because that's all left out of the record.
The Illinois Department of Human Rights is an investigatory body, and that sometimes does and sometimes does not lead to a case being filed before the Illinois Human Rights Commission. We did not file a case before the Illinois Human Rights Commission. Rather, we filed this lawsuit.
All of that's the answer. Thank you.
The cases that I think have to be distinguished that the district court relied upon, Island versus Trinity Hospital. In that case, a nurse made complaints about a doctor. That doctor shortly thereafter referred her for disciplinary action. In that case, they said, no, you cannot impute the doctor's discriminatory animus, and they did so for very clear reasons. The finding that this employee had violated the rules was based upon medical records, and it was based upon an interview with a patient that she had given a measles vaccine to, despite the fact that this lady was pregnant. She did so without checking the record to see that she was pregnant, and she did so without warning the woman that she shouldn't get this shot if she was pregnant. In that case, the decision to terminate did not turn on information provided by the doctor who had discriminatory animus.
Well, wasn't there other evidence here, the fact that Scott's glasses were found 15 feet away from where they had been standing?
Right, and I did say there was slim corroborative evidence, but here's the evidence, Your Honor. Mr. Scott had a redness on the part of the side of his face. Someone indicated that he looked a little disoriented. His glasses were found on the production floor. That's it. You can't conclude from that a rule violation took place, much less that the plaintiff committed the rule violation. Those facts are completely consistent with a trip and a fall. You simply cannot find Mr. Hughes guilty of the rule violation unless you take and accept the statement by Mr. Scott, the allegation by him that he was punched by Mr. Hughes. He's the person who has taken a series of acts against the plaintiff. He is the person that the plaintiff has made a series of complaints about. And, you know, it's interesting, and this is in my brief. There was a 16-month period at the end of Mr. Hughes' employment. And during this period, every 4 months, he got a new supervisor, or actually, more accurately, two guys switched off. Mr. Scott for 4 months, another supervisor. Mr. Scott, another supervisor, every 4 months. When Mr. Scott was in charge, Mr. Hughes was written up repeatedly. The other supervisor never wrote him up in the 16 months at the end of his employment there. So clearly there's a pattern of actions by Mr. Scott showing he has animus towards Mr. Hughes.
Now you're into your rebuttal time.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I will save the rest for that. Right. Thank you very much.
Mr. Schottitz.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. This appeal presents one question. Under what circumstances may the alleged motives of a supervisor or coworker be imputed to the employer in a claim of retaliatory discharge? The jurisprudence of this Court makes clear that there are some circumstances under which it is permissible to impute such motives to the employer, a narrow exception to the general rule that only the motives of those participating in the decision are relevant. But the jurisprudence of this Court makes equally clear that the circumstances of this case do not fall within that narrow exception. When, after being presented with an accusation of misconduct by a supervisor, the employer launches an independent investigation, collects all of the relevant information and evidence that it can, provides both sides with an opportunity to present their version of the events, and based on that independent investigation, the employer reaches the reasonable conclusion and genuinely held belief that the discharge is warranted, then the motives of the supervisor cannot be imputed to the employer. The law also tells us that the employer's conclusion does not have to be right. It need only be genuinely held and honest and reasonable based on the circumstances. What the law does require is that the employer provide a fair degree of process, if you will, and does not allow the supervisor with an alleged retaliatory motive to assert undue influence over that process. By isolating the supervisor from the investigation and providing an appropriate amount of process, the cases say, that breaks the causal link between any purportedly retaliatory motives of the supervisor and the decision to take adverse employment action. The plaintiff does not dispute that Mitsubishi's investigation was thorough and conducted by those without a retaliatory motive.
But the plaintiff argues that there really is a triable issue here because the evidence that was left when you take Scott's allegations out or Scott's statements out are very, very thin.
However, The plaintiff does argue that. First of all, I think he mischaracterizes the evidence that was left. The glasses were found, as Your Honor mentioned, 15 feet away. They were also, the condition of the glasses indicated that they were broken. There was the denial of the accusation by the plaintiff himself, in which he indicated that he had waved his hands in a swiping motion near the supervisor's face. So there are other things that the employer was looking at when it decided that this had occurred. In addition, we're not saying that you can completely remove the accusation from the supervisor. Obviously, you have to. The employer would not have even known. But what he's claiming is that simply by presenting, by reporting the fact that it occurred, that that somehow drove the investigation. But that can't be right, because under that reading of the law, an employer's hands would be completely tied if a supervisor who had previously been accused of discrimination reported an attack by the complainant. So what happened here was the employer, when it learned this piece of information, the focus needs to be on what the employer did to test that information, to try and figure out what had actually occurred. And in this case, the employer did everything that you could possibly ask the employer to do. The focus of this litigation is not on whether or not the punch actually occurred. That is for a different forum altogether. And in fact, in this case, that decision has already been addressed by an arbitration. And to answer in part what Judge Coffey was asking, in that arbitration, which took place after the decision from the court below here, it was determined that the punch did occur and that the employer did have good cause for the termination. However, the fact that the employer was presented with the information is not the critical fact, and the fact that whether or not the punch happened, it's what the employer did once it was presented with this situation. And there really isn't too much more that you could ask of the employer here. They interviewed 6 or 7 people, every single person that possibly had any information relating to the incident, where it occurred, the person found the glasses. The employer interviewed all of those people separately. The employer talked to the plaintiff. The employer talked to the person who had made the accusation. The employer documented all of the evidence with which it was presented, took pictures of the supervisor's face, the injuries that had occurred, took pictures of the glasses to document their condition. That is the critical inquiry here. What does the employer do when it's presented with a claim that someone has violated company policy? There is another point that I want to raise, because it was raised by the plaintiff in his argument, and that is the timing of this case. The timing evidence is pretty clear that there was a charge filed with the EEOC in March of 2003, and this termination occurred in July of 2003. It was over 4.5 months later. So there is no permissible inference that can be drawn, and the cases clearly say that a span of 4 months is too long to draw any inference. In his brief on reply, the plaintiff makes an argument that the supervisor was not his supervisor for 4 of those 4.5 months between the alleged between his charge and the termination. In addition to the fact that this argument is not supported by the case law, that just because he was not his supervisor during that time would make that 4-month span any shorter, and it was not presented to the court below, it's also not factually supported by the record below. As the plaintiff's counsel mentioned, he bases his argument on the fact that the supervisors rotated between day shift and night shift every 4 months, and that if Scott was his supervisor in March 2003, then when he filed his EEOC charge, that he must not have been his supervisor for the next 4 months. But the record does not bear that out, and I felt I needed to address this because it was first raised in the reply brief on appeal. First, Scott shows up as the supervisor on a corrective action notice that was issued to Hughes regarding events that took place in June 2003. Second, under Hughes's theory, Scott would not have been his supervisor in July 2003, during the events that led to his termination. And third and most important, Hughes' own testimony at deposition makes clear that the normal rotation of supervisors did not take place in the months preceding his termination. At his deposition, he was asked, "And it continued like that in four-month rotations between Kirk and Gary until your employment ended?" And his answer was yes. Except for at the end, Gary stayed more than 4 months at the end, I do believe. He stayed more. He was supposed to be transferred, but never was. He stayed longer. So the fact is that Mr. Scott was his supervisor for the last 8 months of his employment with Mitsubishi. He also mentioned in his argument the timing of the corrective action notices and somehow tries to say that those indicate that there is a connection because of the fact that the corrective action notices were issued to the employee later. But the fact is that when a discipline was issued, the supervisor had to go present those facts, just like he did in this case. He had to go and present the facts of those previous infractions to the HR department. Those had to be investigated, and so the discipline does not end up being issued until a later time. So it wasn't that the discipline that he wrote it up for the very first time so much later. The cases that are actually most similar, and this is the important thing, there are broad principles that you can draw or statements that you can draw from some of these cases that say if the information provided by the supervisor affects the decision, that the motives may be imputed. But if you actually look at the circumstances of those cases, you will see that some of them, they allow for the motive to be imputed, and some of them don't. The ones where they do not allow for the motive to be imputed, for instance, Willis v. Marion County Auditor's Office, are situations in which the employer is presented with the information, and then the employer takes that information and probes it, tests it, tries to come to a reasonable conclusion based on what it's been giving. If, on the other hand, in the cases that plaintiff cites to, there are situations where the information is just presented as part of an evaluation process, and the employer has no reason to disbelieve it. They accept it at face value and move forward. But in the situations where they actually test the information, they probe it, they compare it to other objective evidence, like the glasses, like the testimony of other people, like the mark on the face, then the motive is not imputed to the employer. And at this point, I've finished. The defendant will rest on its oral argument and its briefs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time?
2.5 minutes.
2.5 minutes. And before you address what you want to address, could you just deal with this issue of process and what more you think Mitsubishi could have done? I know you think that the outcome was not supported, but was there anything else they could have done in terms of conducting this investigation?
Here's the problem. I apologize. Here's the problem with the process argument that counsel is making. It's not supported by any case law. There's no cases he has cited that says, well, if you have a process and you conduct an investigation and you act in good faith, then that cuts off the
question is, was the company giving an honest statement when they said they canned him because he got in a fight?
You know what? I can't answer that question.
I know, but I mean, that's the ultimate issue in the case, isn't it?
It really is not, Your Honor.
Why
it
not?
Really is not. And the reason is not is because their acting in good faith is not the issue. Every case cited by the defense
here. If their sincere belief is they're firing a guy because he was a fighter, he beat somebody up or whacked his supervisor, that's a legitimate reason for firing somebody, isn't it?
It is a legitimate reason.
And if they really believed it.
And the cases that say if they have a good faith belief, then that's good enough, and it cuts the cord. Every one of those cases, Your Honor, is a fact situation where the information that was based on came from a source other than the person with discriminatory animus. And let me give you an illustration. Counsel cites Willis versus Marion County. That was an important enough case that's the one he cited by name. In that case, while there's general language that says what Your Honor says, In that case, the plaintiff made a complaint about a supervisor and says she was fired in retaliation. There's a rule in that county that if you get 3 write-ups in a year, you're gone.
I'm familiar with the case.
Pardon me?
I'm familiar with the case.
Well, and the point is, under those facts, the first 2 write-ups occurred before the protected conduct, so they can't be retaliatory. The third write-up occurred when the supervisor that had discriminatory animus was on vacation. A different supervisor that has had no discriminatory animus made that decision. So clearly there could not have been retaliation in that case. It's the same case, the same with the Byrd case that's cited by the defendant. In this case, the violation that the plaintiff was fired for was based upon observations by people other than the supervisor that had discriminatory animus. Here in this case, there's no question what happened. They could not conclude that Mr. Hughes struck a blow unless they accepted the testimony from the supervisor that had discriminatory animus. His animus has to be imputed to the defendant in this case because that's what all the cases say. That's what Day versus Colt says. That's what all the other cases that have been cited by the plaintiff here say.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement and will...